welcome to Talking Early Years with me, Juno Sullivan, who hosts this for the Early Years. Today I have a really wonderful guest. We have Professor Norma Raines, who's come to us from Whitchurch in Shropshire, but I think has probably got quite a lot of London connections. I'm sure she'll share them with you in a minute. We met Norma about 3 years, maybe 4 years ago now, and she was really interested in what I call multi-generational approach, which was really engaging people from different generations to work with small children, but not in that sort of traditional, you know, I've been in the war type thing, but actually in a much more interesting, creative way, and actually using people's skills and recognizing the joy that you can bring from being both to the people who are older and not necessarily in their dotage either. We're talking here anyone sort of 50 plus, you know, and our smallest children. And as a consequence of that, Norma, who runs an organisation called From Generation to Generation, presented at our annual Margaret Horn debate and was a very popular person. And there was lots of responses about her work afterwards. And so we would have seen her much sooner than this, but the pandemic got in the way. So this is the first time I've seen Norma for nearly 3 years. And she's now sitting in London with me. And I'm very pleased to have her here. And I'm very pleased to hear her story, which, of course, is turned into a whole manifest of wider things, which she'll tell you about as well as we go along. So welcome, Norma.
Oh, thank you, June. It's a pleasure to be here, actually. It's a pleasure to have got to know you too. But I'm very happy to be here.
Very good. So I without boring you to death by asking you the sort of standard questions, it would be really interesting, I think, just to find out your story, because you've been working with children and been in this world for a long time, and I'm undoubtedly seen a lot of changes and probably seen things that should have changed a long time ago still with us.
Well, okay, as briefly as I can, because I'm desperately old, so we'll cram it into as short a space of time as possible. I actually got trained as a teacher, and I think I really, really wanted to be an early years teacher, but anyway, I wasn't. From that job, which was a really interesting one, in Dollis Hill many years ago, I supported some secondary modern school kids to do GCSEs. I went on to work with a brilliant man called Jack Chizard, and Jack's passion was to show everybody that no child is ineducable, and he did some of the really cutting-edge work to show this in a real way, in a practical way. I worked with him with some friends now, a long time, on a child welfare project which the Americans supported, and we looked at the way children were being cared for, if you like, in different kinds of settings to enable them to grow, or as it sometimes turned out, to prevent them from growing in a really wide and wonderful sense. So we looked at different settings, residential care homes, hospitals, community settings, and so on. And from there, I went on to work in America in the oldest school, it was called. It was an institution for people with learning difficulties, developing measures all the way through from working with Jack about the quality of the service and what it was that promoted quality rather than inhibited, if you like. I don't really remember the next, but I came back to England. I remember doing that. I went on and trained properly as a teacher, and then I went back to doing research around what quality meant to people who were older, in the community and in various residential settings. And then I realised that there was a connection, a real connection of importance between older and younger people, and that's how From Generation to Generation basically came into existence. And here I am talking to you.
Perfect. And Jack Tizard, I remember reading about him when I was doing my studies on early years, because I started off in psychiatry.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I started off as a psychiatric nurse. I worked at the Maltz, trained at the Maltz.
Oh, well, you will know about Jack.
Yes, exactly. And it's just very interesting early years, isn't it? It's like a spider full of webs and weaving. I know we have, like, the New Zealand, they use the term te whariki, don't they, as a sort of woven mat. But there is something in that.
Yes, there is.
It's very interesting that the question or the issue you raise around quality. And quality continues to be a contested issue. If you were to sort of pick on two or three things, what still resonates with you as kind of elements of quality that you found back in the day, both working with older people and working in the community and working with children with additional needs?
Well, I think really, first of all, it's the person, the individual that you're working with.
Right.
And recognizing they're part of the action, they're part of the process, they're part of the growing. And there's real reciprocity between you as the early years provider and the child, and you as the old person and the child, etc. So I think recognizing that individual is where we all ought to start from. And then I think joy, oddly enough, or perhaps not oddly, is an important part of that interaction, and being willing to share the wonder and the opportunities to see the wonderful nature of the world, actually, to help people grow. So helping people grow is a massively important indicator of quality rather than sitting people in rows and dripping knowledge into their mouths or heads or whatever. Or the worst thing I ever saw in my life, when I moved from big residential care homes for children, the cottage-type homes, into a hospital for the first time, and there are all these little kids sitting on the floor in the bathroom, and some of them appeared to have jam all over their faces. And I said to my colleague, well, they must have had jam and bread and jam for tea. And he said, no, that's not what they had. They've been self-lacerating. And they were all sitting on this bathroom floor, about 30 of them, not as bad as in America with them being hosed down, but there they were. Nobody was thinking about them as little individuals. They were blobs sitting on the floor, etc. So, you know, that isn't quality. That's to deny the individual and not to help them grow. And to treat them in this kind of rock way, that's the only way I can describe it.
So in terms of that sort of, you know, the way you frame that sort of resonates with me as a sort of social pedagogical kind of approach. And I discovered social pedagogy many years ago, actually, when I was working, oddly enough, working with older people. It's right. Interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting.
Yeah, and I kind of have, there isn't a vast amount of it in the early years. It's something that we're very interested in, and we framed our pedagogy here at LEAP within that kind of social context. But the thing that kind of really is powerful from what you've just said is that whole relationship between a person and the adult. And of course, we're still stuck with that at the moment, in the sense that we recognize the importance of well-trained, well-supported, you know, thoughtful, sensitive, empathetic staff. But we have never been really given the kind of, I guess, it's probably funding, structure, support to actually really put a good sort of infrastructure around that. How does, you know, where are you with that? And do you think that some of the work you're doing with older people in terms of mentoring might be a way of supporting, just touching the human in, you know, the inside of you, rather than necessarily you can't solve the problem of qualifications, but is there a way that we can use the work you're doing and more in a more interesting way, in a more creative way, rather than always thinking about that kind of linear, let's just get some training, let's sort of that out, which I'm not saying isn't important, you know.
No, there's a lot of interesting questions all bundled together. Let me see if I can address them all one by one. So social pedagogy is probably the most important form of training that anybody working with children in the early years should be getting. The battle has been raging for years and years and years to try and do something and to value the work that goes on in early years. And we still haven't got it. We've got the loud eye. I can't remember when that happened. And everybody was very excited about that. And I don't know what's happened to that, to be honest, but it doesn't seem to be part of social pedagogy. See, Peter Moss spent years trying to get it introduced generally. And I think so did I and other people I know. And there is something very odd about the roots of British attitudes to early years and growth and development of our children. I still don't totally understand it, but I think some of it has got to do with putting your children away, out of sight and out of mind, in order for you to get on with your life if you were a member of the British aristocracy or, I don't know, wealthy classes, etc. Children have never been treated in the wonderful way Italians and part of Italy have treated them and valued them. And often, even today, children get frowned at by people in restaurants and so on, or on buses. Instead of greeted by your wonderful receptionist today, as my grandchildren were, I think there is a way to use what older people have got to give without formalising it in some sort of educational curriculum manner. If you look at what the Americans did about this, and they trained everybody, the people who were developing this kind of approach years ago, I've taken the view that you don't train older people. First of all, they've managed miraculously to survive for quite a long time. And simply by doing that, they have learnt a lot of lessons. Otherwise, they wouldn't still be with us, would they? So what we've done is use that knowledge in a framework that the schools value. So the schools have actually led the way here, and they say to us, we want such and such, we want, you know, people to listen to children read, we'd like some musicians, we'd like some gardeners, we'd like some whatever. And then the job of our coordinators was to go and find people who've got this passion, this skill that they'd acquired over the years, and now time, because nobody was employing them, etc., and a willingness to share this knowledge. So, and then we'd process them in the formal kind of way with the DBS checks and so on, and interview them and go take up references, and then they'd be introduced to schools. And it would be entirely up to the school to match them with a classroom of children or a, you know, reception level, and let the teachers work together with the older person to start them off at least. And then what happened is something I think quite miraculous, but then I suppose not. It's almost inevitable if you live to 60, 70. Our oldest intergener, as we call them, was 100.
Wow.
And he had been a vegetarian for 8 years, right? He had grown up, he had to go and work with his dad in the East End of London as a tailor. He was a really, so he'd lived the life, but gone through the bombs and the, you know, blah blahs, etc., the wounded soldiers, and asked his parents what they were. He ended up being a cutter for Dior, I think. So when he went to school in one of the secondary schools, first of all, he was a walking history book.
Yes.
And then secondly, he did go to do some sessions with the design students. You know, now, we couldn't train for that,
no.
But we could recognise his training and his skills, put in a formal structure that the school basically created for him. And then we've got jazz musicians, we've got people who just came and listened to children read because that's what the school wanted. And that. But then they would say, and tell me if I'm going on too much, they would say, oh, what's that funny brown mark on your hands, right? And so there would be a conversation about that. And because the child was black and the person who was with them was white, they were able to discuss why she wouldn't have one of these brown marks, not that would be discernible anyway. And the child, I remember this story very well, because the child said, well, that'll be one good thing for me then, won't it? Mm. So you can, you know. And I think the other side of this is that the older people got so much satisfaction from being part of the community, that they would go on to say, look, I can teach baking if you like me to teach baking, or I can do this. Because often they would go to school quite terrified, because they've not been in school for 50 years. And the press tell you not a good story about schools, even in the, you know, even down at the, in the nurseries. That's better than what they tell you about secondary schools. But they're not places that older people know and are not part of their daily life until you introduce them in this way and make them feel welcome. So have I answered your question?
Well, it's very interesting, because what you're saying is, it's, as I understand it, is that it's about the appreciation of people's kind of lived life and how we use it. But it's also about, in a way, opening up an opportunity. It's kind of the social pedagogy thing about the professional, the personal, and the private kind of all coming together in that three P's notion,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And if anything, it's about unpacking those three P's and discovering that the personal. So you talked about that, you know, that man who was, you know, personally would have been probably quite affected by being in the war in the East End, which, you know, was undoubtedly very hard hit by all sorts of stuff. Professionally became a, you know, a tailor and worked for a big, you know, international company. And privately was probably figuring out for himself his relationship with all of that all the way through. And then weaving that together, you get a much more integrated human person that can actually share. And that's what you're saying, isn't it?
It's exactly what I'm saying, yes. And I think we waste massively in this country. We waste young children's lives still doing it by not giving them the educational start and the early years environment in which to develop and feel confident and grow. We waste older people's lives because we just say, well, that's it then, isn't it? Something called work is finished and now you're retired. And you used to hang around for a year and wait to die, but of course we now have these extended lives because of all the things that have been enabled, many of them political things, but good health and good education for many people and so on. So we are all living longer. We're not just dying one year after we finish work. And that's such a waste because the talent, the skills, the knowledge of those people and the time, and all we hear about from one government after another is we haven't got enough money. Well, it's sitting there waiting, that's a pool of talent to enrich the lives of children. And
It's a really good call, actually, and I think in lots of early year settings there is a kind of understanding of this. Sometimes it's called intergenerational, which I totally get, but I suppose I was a bit scathing at the beginning because when I was developing our approach at LEAF to that, it was probably 15 years ago. When you talked, you know, when people talked about intergenerational, it really, really was bring them in for a history lesson. What was it like then? And to me, I couldn't see how that would work with small children. But when we invited people in because we liked them, or we did a grandparents' tea and they said, I don't mind coming back and doing stuff, you suddenly moved from the sort of more traditional, I'll knit the dolly's clothes for you, of which I am totally grateful because I end up knitting quite a lot of it otherwise, I'm happy to come and do baking, I'm happy to come and make Play-Doh, I'm happy just to be outdoors, I'm a bird watcher, I'm at this, you know, and suddenly, you know, it became a much more open conversation. But also for us, particularly here in London, a lot of the children are coming into communities that are changing very rapidly. And we did this piece with a charity called Groundworks called Passport to Pimlico. And it was originally one of those 1940s films. I don't know if you ever saw it. Yeah, it was quite funny. And they did a retake of it. But of course, now Passport to Pimlico had people from all over parts of the world. Yeah. And it was really interesting about how we had the original Pimlico people, you know, who still here and live here and know this neighbourhood, tell you the whole history of it, and new members in, and us with our small children trying to find a place for them in the community. And it led to a most interesting set of conversations where people said, I never would have said hello to her before, I would never have known that, suddenly becoming connected, knowing people on the estate, all that sort of stuff. So to me, it made no sense not to build that kind of cultural and social capital by weaving the two things together. But I think the narrative around that hasn't really been properly explored. And I'm just wondering how organisations like yours can help to expand that narrative. So it's not simply about coming in and doing stuff. It's about connecting and creating relationships, but also helping children find a place in the community that's changing. Also finding all people their place in a community that's changing. And much broader than that. It's the kind of Robert Putnam bridging and bonding idea rather than coming into the school, reading a story, going home again.
Absolutely that. And over the years, I've completely changed my thinking about it. I hardly ever use the word intergenerational or multigenerational. This is about sharing place and space. Mm. And the place and space, we've done most of our sharing, and we're just about to do a new one, I'll tell you about it in a moment, but was the school. Because it's heated and lit and there. It is exactly about building bridges and bonding, and it is done by sharing place and space. So I talk about this thing, generation to generation, as a way in which you use the sharing of place and space to bring older and younger people together. It could be anybody else. It's their sharing place and space, but actually, within that context, there are lots of places where young people, kids are, little children are, and they're all over the place. There are 26,000 plus schools in this country for a start, never mind the nurseries, etc. If you see, and you add it on. Well, there they are. So why not share that in an organised way and build those wonderful... It works. And my example, I can tell you, is a personal one. I went into school to see why people were raving about this opportunity, older people being given, and why the heads were continuing to use the service. So I spent a term listening to children read. It isn't for me. I was happy enough to do it. But there I am outside on a Saturday doing my shopping, and a little child runs right across a plaza to me and says, "Hello, hello, Norma." And her mother, of course, is terrified and runs after the child. And then the child says, "No, no, this is Norma, and she listens to me read at school." So I spoke to the mother, etc., etc. I met kids in swimming pools, and I met older people in swimming pools who said, "Oh, I really like what I'm doing." And so all those bonding, that bridge building, happens not just within the school, but it spills out into the community. And we've started this entirely community-based one now in the Caldecott Festival, where we are working in a small community to bring generations together, focused on this man and his art and his inspiration, Mr. Caldecott. And we're going to have a festival to celebrate his life and his work and his inspiration to keep on going and live your dreams. So, and again, it's different generations. The people who did our first windows were aged 7 to 81. And it's all possible. And if you stop thinking about it, most intergenerational things, to be blunt about it, appear to have faded like the driven snow. Yes. They don't get long-term funded. They haven't become part of the mainstream.
Exactly.
And it's making all of this mainstream. And I think it is about building those ties and ensuring the richness that we've got in our communities is recognised and encouraged to be used in the fullest possible way.
I mean, I totally agree with you on that. It's the seventh strand of our pedagogy, so that it's not a project funded. And now I get a bit depressed by that. You know, someone has a new idea and they think, oh, yes, we'll set up this. And someone says, that's a great idea. But then if it's not integrated into the whole way of doing things, it always ends up as a nice to have. Whereas I actually think it's more than a nice to have. Yeah. Because I think if we're talking about building communities, we need to think about the nursery as a catalyst in that community. Like you say, school is equally good as a catalyst because it's got building, it's got access. But it's about, surely, isn't it about changing attitudes to access? So, I mean, we've often run into difficulties where we want to do extra stuff, but we can't find a space. You go to the school and there's a whole hoo-ha about safety and school keepers and locking up. And I can't tell you. And I just think, seriously, we'll do the locking up. We're not going to do any vandalism here. We're going to look after the building. But do you find those kind of barriers, or do you think they're breaking down now with more sort of forward-thinking heads?
I think I'm familiar with them. not every head of every school we approach jumped at the idea of having this opportunity to enrich the lives of their kids. But there are more heads who are willing to do this, I think, now, and don't put blockage in the way. Schools have been wildly protective of keeping their arms around their space in case people wreck their drawings or paintings. I don't know what else. But I think maybe that's going to take a long time, but actually allowing people in and welcoming people, and because that's the other side of it, I can tell you about schools which were not welcoming. They let people in, but they sat them outside the staff room. And so that's not quality. That's so sensibly, some of the volunteers said, "I don't want to know about this, thank you." But we could work through that blockage in the head, so we've got our toes over the doorstep, as it were. And this wasn't added on. This was something that they could see. In the best head I know to describe this talked about what was going on in the classrooms as a black box. She said, "You bring these older people in, the children, etc., etc., and all the schools use their volunteers very differently, very different ways. And she said, but we don't know what is going on between that child and that elder person at all. That's the black box. But it's some kind of magic because they get to know each other. Yes, they're there to listen to children read, or yes, they're there to work on a project or whatever. But all these other things are going on. So the child and the older person are talking about all sorts of things you never get to know about.
Precisely. It's about building the relationship, isn't it?
Exactly that.
And it's about, I think for some, it's really about breaking down barriers because I don't know the exact statistics here, but across our own nurseries, and we have 40 of them, a lot of our children don't know their grandparents. Now, not because they don't exist, but because they're living over here, or they are far away, or there's complexity in the relationships, or, you know, there's extended families, and but it's like perhaps it's very extended, and so they don't actually know their grandparents. So, you know, you can't assume that there's this automatic relationship at home for these families. So surely connecting with other people who kind of fill a sort of a role without replacing them, but actually fills a role where a younger child gets to know an older person and an older person isn't terrified by a small child. Surely that's something that actually weaves a kind of weft of harmonious relationships and a kind of, you know, interconnection. That is what we talk about when we talk about quality and we talk about that in our years.
That's absolutely right. And I say one of the, this is a thing of, this is about reciprocity, a lot of this. So it's not just a one way.
Precisely.
At all. And I think you see in many ways the advantage of this approach. And you see it. It is about sharing. It is about enrichment for everybody. It's not a one-way street. Older people will tell you how much they have got and they've arisen for getting out of bed. And they feel valued again. And children learn lots of new things as well as what their, you know, what the instrumental purpose of the relationship in the context of the school is meant to be. So there's more learning going on there. So I think this is really important to just. And one way of making it mainstream is to see it as sharing a place and space and for mutual advantage. You know, it's not multi-generational. It so happens there are older and younger people involved, just like there are building the Caldecott Festival, which is going to take place, celebrate that man's life and his inspiration next year in Shropshire, in this little town where he lived for 6 years. Drawing and learning about life, etc. So, but he went on to live his dream, and in many ways, this sharing of place and space, as I say, will enable and help people to go on to live their dreams, older people and children in early years, I think. You know, when you can see what people can do, even if they aren't fit as a fiddle and all the rest of it. That's a message to kids, isn't it?
Yep.
It's an inspiration.
Absolutely. And two last things before we go. One is I just want to know a bit about your plan for the kind of replication of from generation to generation, so out of Shropshire and beyond. And just on the point of, it's Randolph Caldecott.
Yes.
And he was a children's illustrator who broke all sorts of new ways of doing things, imitated by Beatrix Potter, and a really unusually sort of forward-thinking chap in the world of children's illustrations. So that's a celebration of him next year as a festival. And then separately, what's your plan for From Generation to Generation?
We hope it will continue to spread around. We are looking for people who replicate its practices. They're freely available on the website now, www.intergen.org.uk. Everything you need to set up the kind of schools model I was talking about, or to apply it to an early years setting, is all there. We hope more people will give us data or, you know, explore the impact so that this can become something people recognise as a whole way of bringing the experience of older people to share in schools with younger people, and for the older people to learn from the younger people in schools too. So this two-way, this reciprocity I'm talking about, is really there, and it's a value to the schools, to the communities they are part of, to the children who are there learning, and to the teachers who are trying to help them do the learning. So hopefully it will be replicated and more data will become available about its impact on the academic performance as well as the psychological performance. We've been seeking people to do this, and we welcome anybody.
So there's a shout out there for anyone who's willing to lead a piece of research on the work you're doing from generation to generation. Call it what you will, but we'll frame it that way. And that's through www.intergen.co.uk.
.org.uk.
Okay. So, Fionn, for www.intergen.org.uk. And then the Caldecott celebration is next March?
Next March the 19th, to be precise, on a Saturday.
Okay.
And that's in Whitchurch itself, in Shropshire. It's an all-day event, and it will be fun and full of creativity and opportunities.
And you've got some great speakers coming.
We've got some great speakers. We've got Leonard Marcus coming from New York, no less. We've got illustrators coming from all over this country. And, well, wait and see, and come and see, is what I would say.
I'm hoping that you will connect with the charity that I sit on the board of, and a very, very wonderful charity called Book Trust. And I think you probably need to connect with them.
Oh, I'd love to connect with them. What a great idea.
So we will I will certainly introduce you to them. We've also done a podcast with Diana Gerald on the matter of the power, you know, the power of children's books. And I think what you're doing is adding to that another layer by, you know, capturing the work of Randolph Caldecott. So thank you very, very much for coming in. Coming all the way down from Shropshire, a county in our house we know very well, because my mother-in-law lives there. In fact, I was married there.
A small world.
It is indeed a small world. And my mother-in-law still lives there in her 98th year. So, yes, we would be delighted to advertise your Caldecott event as well, even though it feels like it's a long way from here. But the point is well made. And we will certainly do our best to advocate on your behalf the work of why intergenerational, multi-generational work is not to be an add-on, but actually integrated into early years pedagogy.
Absolutely.
So thank you again.
Thank you very much for letting me talk to you and share these ideas. I really, really appreciate it.
Not at all. Pleasure. All pleasure's all mine. Thank you for joining me today. If you like what you heard, please share it or check us out on our website, leaf.org.uk.